I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. So what do you do the day after you make history? Well, President-elect Barack Obama played basketball and took his kids to school. Tomorrow, he'll begin making hiring decisions. Let's see how the world is reacting on this day after. We're going to start in Washington. Liz Halloran is senior writer for U.S. News and World Report. She joins us from D.C. And Liz, we saw pictures of people around the world reacting to Obama's election and a very gracious concession speech from John McCain. But what's the feeling there in Washington?
Last night it was wild, Robin. The streets were filled with students here in Georgetown, where our office is, and in the street, U Street, which is a street about 2 miles north of the White House that was decimated by race riots, was filled with just a rainbow coalition of people celebrating, and there were people celebrating outside the White House. But this morning, I think people are a little bit tired and trying to read the tea leaves of where Barack Obama will go with his administration.
I guess that's what I mean. What's the feeling in the big marble buildings?
Well, it's interesting. You leave it to The Onion, the parody newspaper, to say a black man given nation's worst job. Right now, he has named Rahm Emanuel as his chief of staff, and as you know, he's a savvy, tough insider who knows how to legislate. He's no yes man, and he'll be a good a foil for President-elect Obama, or President Obama, when he's in office. Mm-hmm. Considering potentially Lawrence Summers as finance chief, that's a very, very important position. People want to know who's going to be in there and start sort of parsing out where that policy might go. So it's and the Republicans are obviously trying to regroup. Mike Huckabee had an email out early this morning trying to bolster the party, and Mitch McConnell last night is talking about, there will be time to legislate, and we will legislate. So there's a lot of talk about how this is going to shake out.
Well, and what about the margin of victory? Obama defeated Republican John McCain by less than 6 percentage points in the popular vote, but in the Electoral College, much more lopsided. The latest AP count is 349 for Obama, 147 for McCain. Is he, as George Bush did years ago, going to come out and say he has a mandate?
I'm not sure that's the language that Senator Obama would use, but I think you are safe in characterizing it as a rout. I mean, the Democrats are going to pick up at least 5 seats in the Senate, at least 17 in the House. He certainly does have, he brought along a number of these people, so he certainly does have a Congress that is going to be wanting to work with him very closely.
And yet we still don't know if the Democrats are going to have a filibuster-proof Congress because some race is too close to call. Liz Halloran, senior writer for U.S. News and World Report, thank you so much I'm sure it was a long night for you. Thanks so much for giving us some time today.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, President George Bush, the man Barack Obama will succeed in January, spoke at the White House this morning.
There'll be a stirring sight to watch President Obama, his wife Michelle, and their beautiful girls step through the doors of the White House. I know millions of Americans will be overcome with pride at this inspiring moment that so many have waited so long.
President Bush also paid tribute to the losing ticket of John McCain and Sarah Palin and said he's invited President-elect Obama and his wife to come to the White House. Julian Zelitzer is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School, a frequent guest on Here and Now, and we want to have him here for the hour today. But just a couple of your initial thoughts, Julian. What was your thought last night when it was obvious that this was going to be the outcome?
Well, I think like all Americans, there's a historic nature to this. You think here we have an African-American president. It's something most people didn't think would happen in their lifetime. Then there's the political dimension. On the one hand, Democrats have a big victory and a lot of power now. And on the other hand, there's a lot of challenges to them and the responsibility of having united government that they're going to have to deal with.
Well, in fact, you write that all presidents have 100 days to show what they're made of, and some have blown it. And in this case, with the economic crisis and 2 wars, it's even more important.
Oh, absolutely. He's taking office in the hardest of times, President Obama. Bad economy, no money, and a fragile, shaky war at best. So he's going to have to start with a broken situation rather than taking over when the economy is growing and we have surpluses. It's a challenging time, but some presidents have made good from that situation.
Well, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt comes to mind. We want you to stay with us, Julian, because we want to hear more about that later in the program. Julian Zelitzer, our sort of Here and Now historian from Princeton. And now, sticking with Princeton, we want to just bring in Melissa Harris Lacewell. She's Associate Professor of Politics and African American Studies at Princeton. She writes the blog The Kitchen Table with her Princeton colleague, Dr. Yolanda Pierce. And Melissa, first of all, what was your reaction last night?
Just wow.
Well, I was going to ask, you know, what was your, you know, very personal feeling? You've researched and prepared and studied, but in that moment last night, what'd you think?
Yeah, in that moment last night, it had nothing to do with being a political scientist. It's kind of sad, really, how little it had to do with being a political scientist. I expected to sort of have a scholarly reaction to it, but instead I was responding very viscerally, very much from my gut, as you know, an interracial woman, the daughter of both a black man who grew up in the Jim Crow South and a white woman from the West, someone who lived in Hyde Park and attended Trinity United Church of Christ. It was just a very, very personal and yet incredibly collective victory.
What does it mean for the country, do you think?
Just for the country on the most basic level, it means a change of regime, a change of direction. I almost hate to use the word change. It's become cliche. But I think that, you know, this kind of particular relationship that Barack Obama has as the grandson of the greatest generation of a grandfather who fought in World War II and a grandmother who was a Rosie the Riveter, that he brings both this kind of community service tradition from the African-American community and this sense of the greatest generation and their relationship to the state that we would sacrifice for our country, but our country would then provide for us things like a decent education and quality housing and a reasonable opportunity for retirement. So I think this moment means writing a new social contract between American citizens and their government.
Well, it's funny because we talked with you early on in the campaign when the fact that Barack Obama was mixed race was something that, you know, people wondered if that was going to be off-putting to many black Americans, the fact that he wasn't. Remember, we had the discussion of whether or not he was black enough. And he certainly, I mean, that certainly did change. He got, you know, a huge percentage of the African-American vote.
Well, this has been, you know, my joke with my students is that as a scholar of race, one of the things I'm often trying to convince students of is that race is a social construction, not a biological reality. Boy, it really worked in this case because we saw Barack Obama go from being not black enough to being way too black to being labeled as some kind of outsider to ultimately last night becoming an American in a truly full and complete sense of what it means to be an American citizen.
He won in the suburbs. He won with what were being called post-boomers. These are young people. 66% of young voters supported Barack Obama, and we heard young people saying last night they didn't see him as black or white. So are you saying we are in post-race America, that phrase? You know, we keep wondering, are we there?
Well, if we were in post-race America, the primary story on every single news network would not be that he's the first African-American president. So we are clearly still within an America which understands race. But I think we are in an expanding racial America in this sense. Barack Obama not only won that youth vote, that vote which does see race quite differently than its elders, he also won a greater percentage of the white vote than any Democrat since Carter. He won a greater percentage of the overall vote, 53%. So this is someone who didn't win just with kind of a coalition of the marginalized. He won a vast coalition of Americans into taking the Democratic Party into the South, into the West, truly an astonishing victory that I think suggests that as a country, we found common ground across racial difference.
Well, do you worry, though, about those millions of Americans who don't feel that common ground and still feel fear? The Atlanta Constitution underscored that today. They talked to people, one quoted as saying, isn't Obama a Muslim? You know, as a pejorative, a woman who worked for a heating and air conditioning company saying that she and her friends are scared. Now, she didn't say why, but if you listen to right-wing talk radio, they are being told that Barack Obama is a domestic terrorist, that he won't defend his country, that he's the other. Now, you know, he did win big, but there's still 46% of America that didn't vote for Barack Obama. And of course, we know people voted for John McCain for, you know, many other reasons. But there are Americans today waking up feeling left out of this new compact.
Oh, no doubt. Just as last night, Barack Obama invoked Abraham Lincoln and suggested that we found a way to come together as a country, even across the huge rift that was the Civil War. But of course, that's a very neat story, and doesn't reflect just how painful the division of the Civil War was, how difficult it was for former Confederates to, in fact, give up slavery, or even how difficult it has been in the U.S. South, in the urban North, even to the West, for many white Americans in a post-Jim Crow era to accept the possibility of full racial equality for African Americans, for Latinos, and of course, this huge fight currently existing on the question of gay marriage and whether or not we're going to move into this new equitable world while, you know, holding back gay men and lesbians as part of the coalition. So, no, is all of America all on board together to sing kumbaya and walk into the future? No. But it turns out we don't need that as a country. We just have to find a way to govern together. So even in the complexity and the messiness, I'm incredibly optimistic this morning.
On the other hand, we spoke of whites being in fear. Are there going to be African Americans who maybe have, in your view, too high an expectation of what Barack Obama can do for them?
No, I ultimately think that the big question for many African Americans isn't what can Barack Obama do for us, but what does an Obama presidency allow us to do for ourselves? How does having a progressive Democrat in the White House, an African American family in the White House, how does that open up a set of possibilities for ordinary people?
Well, how important is the symbol?
Of course the symbol matters. When a cross was burned on your yard, that was a symbol. It was a symbol of hatred. It was a symbol of racism. Now, this is exactly the opposite of that. What this is a great American healing for a moment. Does it mean that American racism is over? Of course not. Does it mean that racial inequality is all worked out? Of course not. What it does mean, I think, for many of us as African Americans, is that we understand now that our country is willing to accept the possibility that black people would not only be governed, but we will have an opportunity to govern. That means that we have moved into an era of full inclusion. Full inclusion doesn't mean everybody's equal. It means everybody has a seat at the table.
Melissa Harris-Lacewell, Associate Professor of Politics and African American Studies at Princeton. And Melissa, I just want to ask, we begin with, you know, your wow, your feeling last night. But I'm wondering, how do you feel today? Do you feel different?
I feel different today. I'm in New York. I've been here doing press. But I'll tell you, I walked around New York this morning and people were just going to work and, you know, living their lives and catching the train. And yet somehow it looked different. This is a different country this morning. This is a country that did something that I did not believe it was capable of doing, and that makes me love it in a very specific and special way. I always loved my country, but I love it in a very particular way this morning.
Professor, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, historian Julian Zelitzer, jump back in for just a second. Do you have a thought on another time in history when the winners, who feel like Melissa does, and the losers had to be brought together?
Sure. I mean, I think with FDR, you had a time in the country where many Americans were kind of becoming more divided, were very despondent. When Richard Nixon's elected in 1968, he had that task, but ultimately he played to the divisions in America rather than trying to heal them. And similarly, Ronald Reagan came out at a time when Democrats and Republicans were very bitterly divided.
Historian Juliet Zelitzer, let's find out what those presidents did. We're going to do that. We're going to take a minute break and also talk about what he feels the president-elect, Barack Obama, must do in this first 100 days to achieve his goals. Back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back. And we are back with Julian Zelitzer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. And Julian, you were just giving us examples of presidents who've had to bring together people after elections, people who were winners and people who were losers. How did some of them do that?
Well, for FDR, it wasn't that, you know, his opponent was so popular. It was more just the nation was coming apart. And he did it in two ways. One, he just did a lot. He proposed a lot of legislation. He was willing to experiment. And he gave Americans confidence that he was going to do something, that he was trying different things. And he also spoke to them in a very effective manner that helped to reassure them and create the sense that he was the leader of the country, not the leader of the Democratic Party. Richard Nixon is another example. He came in a very divided time in American history in 1968. Many people were upset that he had won. He didn't take the path of an FDR or Ronald Reagan. He played on the divisions that had brought him into office. and try to expand his ruling majority that way, and we know the results. Ronald Reagan's the final example. Many people really didn't like Reagan. They didn't like the conservative movement that brought him into power, but he did several things. One, he found legislation that Democrats would support early on, like a tax cut in 1981, and undermined his opposition. And he also found, you know, big themes that he focused on, like anti-communism, that helped to heal some of the tension that existed over his presidency.
Well, I also remember in some of your writing that Ronald Reagan used the FDR method of going directly to the electorate. It wasn't a fireside chat, but it was television. But he went right to them and said, tell your legislators, I want to do this. I want a tax cut.
Absolutely. I mean, it's one of the tools that Barack Obama will have, not just the fact that he's so good on television or in speeches, but he has this kind of mass organizational machine that brought him into office. And he, hopefully for him, that he won't dismantle it. What would be more effective is if he uses it in the next few years to put pressure on Congress, not just through the bully pulpit, but through the organizational pulpit.
I want to ask you, Julian, what you think of what we've heard from Barack Obama, especially in his speech last night. Let's play a clip because we feel he uses a word that we haven't heard from a president in a long time. Let's listen.
This victory alone is not the change we seek. It is only the chance for us to make that change. And that cannot happen if we go back to the way things were. It can't happen without you, without a new spirit of service, a new spirit of sacrifice. So let us summon a new spirit of patriotism, of responsibility, where each of us resolves to pitch in and work harder and look after not only ourselves, but each other.
You notice, Julian, how he lingered over the word sacrifice. He didn't just say it, he lingered over it. Your thoughts?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've written that LBJ, when he takes office, he positions himself as, you know, following through on what John F. Kennedy was trying to do. I think Barack Obama is actually trying to position himself in contrast to President Bush, where the ideas of sacrifice and the ideas of service have not been part of the war on terrorism. They have not been part of the domestic agenda. And I think he wants to kind of tap into an old Democratic tradition of calling on Americans to do something for their country, not just asking him to do something for the country. And I think that will be an important theme, from taxation to national service, that we're going to hear a lot about.
Well, he's also setting the stage, because it's going to be impossible for any one president to do this alone, given what the crises are.
Absolutely. He didn't just talk about that. He said in his acceptance speech that he's going to make mistakes along the way and do things people don't like. He's taking office in the worst of times in many ways. So I think part of what he's saying is, this won't be an easy ride. You're going to have to do some stuff too, not just me. And there'll be things where we have some tension. And I think he's setting the context for a presidency in bad economic times.
Yeah. You're also right that most presidents suffer letdowns in their first year. Kennedy, Reagan, and Nixon being the exceptions. You're going to come back in the program, but in the minute we have, how does Obama avoid that?
Well, Kennedy did it through really a dramatic inaugural address, which was quite important to his presidency. And then he found small targeted policies that he could achieve without angering Congress, like working on desegregating universities. And that helped sustain his support. Reagan, actually, his ratings slip. But what he does is just stick to the big themes of his presidency. And ultimately, people come back to him by 1984.
Princeton's historian Julian Zelitzer. Julian, do you mind standing by? We'll have you back in a few minutes with more.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Because what we want to do is just take a quick look before a break at ballot questions. Some are still undecided today, but let's see what we've got here. On abortion, voters in South Dakota rejected a sweeping ban on abortion. Colorado rejected a measure that would have defined a person as a human being from the moment of fertilization. Doctor-assisted suicide was on the ballot in Washington State, and Washington State becomes the second state after Oregon to allow doctor-assisted suicide for the terminally ill. That ballot initiative question won by 59-41%. Stem cell research. Michigan voters lifted a 30-year ban on stem cell research. Marijuana was on several ballots. Michigan approved the use of marijuana for medical use. whereas Massachusetts becomes the first state to decriminalize possession of less than an ounce of marijuana, and that was also via a ballot initiative. Tax initiatives across the country fared poorly. In Massachusetts, voters handily rejected a plan to eliminate the state's income tax. North Dakotans rejected a measure to cut that state's personal income tax in half and also to reduce corporate taxes. Oregonians rejected a measure that would have let residents deduct federal taxes from state income tax return. And animals were on the ballot in Massachusetts. Voters passed a measure that will end greyhound dog racing by 2010. Opponents of that bill feared that jobs would be cut and it's something that would hit entertainment for the poor as opposed to horse racing. But greyhound dog racing will end in 2010 here in Massachusetts. California became the latest state to approve a measure requiring more humane conditions for farm animals. The measure in California requires pregnant pigs, calves, and egg-laying hens have enough room to turn around in and fully extend their limbs when confined. That ruling goes into effect in 2015. Opponents in California made the point that they will need a lot of time to convert farm areas, but they must now do that, according to a ballot measure passed in California. Just a quick look at some of the ballot measures. Some, again, too close to call. When we come back, several stories for you, including from a colleague of ours, what it was like to grow up in Jim Crow South in Little Rock, Arkansas, to know the Little Rock Nine, to know what it was like to be called a colored girl, and to know the effects of that and the impact of last night. We'll have that ahead. You're listening to Here and Now. So how are the campaigns being reviewed? Well, an editorial in today's New York Times concludes that Barack Obama swept away one political presumption after another to defeat first Hillary Clinton and then John McCain, who forsook his principles for a campaign built on anger and fear. Well, journalist Robert Draper wrote the October 26th cover story about John McCain for the New York Times Sunday magazine. It was titled The Making and Remaking and Remaking of the Candidate, and he joins us now. And Robert, you saw McCain and what you called the changing narrative of his campaign firsthand. They tried to sell him to voters, you write, six different ways. But did he forsake his principles?
Well, I think that's in the eyes of the beholder. I think that this is clearly not the campaign that John McCain wanted. He clearly did not want to spend his last few weeks talking about Bill Ayers and accusing Barack Obama of being a socialist. And no one could possibly imagine that John McCain, who ran such a high-minded campaign in 2000, albeit a losing campaign, waging this sort of performance in the waning weeks of the 2008 race.
But then why did he do it?
Well, I think that they began with the assumption that this was a very inhospitable climate for Republicans and that they were going to have to sort of conduct one bold move after the next. And essentially, they couldn't get their stories straight.
Well, in fact, you describe a meeting in which staffers, there's a stunning moment, you know, where they can't answer the question, why should someone elect John McCain? Again, in trying to come up with the storyline. And this was in June.
Yes. No, that's right. So they are having a lot of difficulty selling this man whose persona was quite recognizable to Americans going back to 1999. And in their continual effort to represent their candidate, the nearly impossible was achieved by the McCain campaign, which was that they reduced this very recognizable figure into one who could barely be recognized by the American public.
Well, Maeve Reston of the Los Angeles Times writes about how McCain changed much earlier on after she asked a question about insurance covering Viagra and not birth control. There was a painful moment for John McCain when he couldn't come up with an answer. It became a YouTube moment. And she describes how the whole mood of the campaign changed. The Straight Talk Express shut down. In fact, he who had been asking her about her engagement and been so engaging with reporters would now stare straight past them. Did you see that shift too?
Yes, though it actually predates what Maeve is talking about. This was because Steve Schmidt had prevailed upon Senator McCain to consider the likelihood that though he'd always had good relations with the press was by and large liberal, was in the tank for Obama, and would cease to be his friend the moment he secured the nomination.
Steve Schmidt, of course, the chief strategist who had also worked for George W. Bush, Karl Rove, although he wasn't close to either of them. But is the failure of the McCain campaign really Schmidt's fault? I mean, how is it that a candidate goes along when, as you and others have said, in his heart he didn't seem to want to.
Yeah, it's not Steve Schmidt's fault. I mean, I think that Schmidt was the hired gunslinger, you know, and the client ultimately bears responsibility. The main problem, Robin, with John McCain's quest for the presidency is that he was never able to explain to Americans how his presidency would be different from that of his predecessor, George W. Bush. He was never able to explain to us why we should vote for, as opposed to just simply admire, this very patriotic American. We could not get a sense concretely of what a McCain presidency would be like, really, and all we had to go by in terms of how he would manage is the nature of his campaign, which, frankly, was managed quite poorly.
Meanwhile, stunning moment last night, pundits and people watching around the world John McCain's concession speech saying out loud or to themselves, where was that John McCain during the campaign, accepting defeat with grace, generosity, urging Americans to unite? The old John McCain.
Right. Well, and we saw that here and there in glimpses. Ultimately, you have to make a case as to why voters should vote for you. And McCain simply was unable to do that. Showing graciousness now and again does not take you across the finish line.
Robert Draper, who wrote about the McCain campaign for the New York Times, he's also a correspondent for GQ and the author of Dead Certain, The Presidency of George W. Bush. Robert, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure.
Well, now let's turn to Los Angeles Times reporter Peter Nicholas, who is speaking to us from Chicago, where he watched Obama's acceptance speech last night. And Peter, you write that you had a very different issue with Obama on the campaign than some of the McCain reporters did. Obama never opened up to you in the way that McCain did and then shut down. You write that Obama was, you know, sort of a bore on the campaign trail.
Well, yes. It's one of the ironies, I think, of Barack Obama is that this charismatic figure who attracts so many supporters and who can draw 100,000-plus people to his rallies, upon direct contact with him, is, you know, something of a bore, something of a one-dimensional figure. I think that what he was doing in this regard was trying to maintain discipline that was needed to stay on message, and he was unwaveringly on message, very disciplined. But I think that came at a price, and the price was that reporters who were traveling with him, and I was among them, really didn't get to very much insight into his temperament and his character. And these are qualities, I think, that are important to know.
Peter, I'm going to jump in to say it obviously didn't come at too much of a price since he won.
Well, exactly right. Give him credit. I mean, this is a strategy that worked for him.
You write about scenes in which, for instance, there's a photo opportunity. Obama's flipping burgers in a backyard barbecue. I remember that. And
yeah.
What happened? Flies started to fly around the burgers?
Well, yeah, there were moments where we did get some insight into who he is, some unscripted moments like that one. That was in Iowa in 2007, and he was at a backyard barbecue and flipping burgers, and we were watching, and, you know, one fly landed on the barbecue, and another fly landed on him, and after a few minutes, there were just flies swarming over the candidate and the barbecue, and it was painful to watch. But he dealt with it coolly and waved them off, and I would have been tempted, I think, to throw the barbecue over the fence, but he's a different animal, and that did show me something, that there's some real cool under fire there.
Well, you write about at one point confessing to him that you were the one who inaccurately reported that he'd refused to fist bump a kid, you know, touch hands together. That isn't what happened, and it snowballed, and you apologized, and he was very gracious. But in that moment, you were wearing a big floppy hat, and you told him it was because of serious son issues in your family, and he got very serious about that.
Yeah, it was a moment where one thing I would try to do as a traveling reporter on Obama's plane was I would try to engage him. I would try to talk to him. And it was difficult because he very seldom came back in the airplane to talk to press, and when he did, it was pretty much on his terms. And that was a moment where I made a joke about his ears being kind of large and maybe not fitting under the hat. He laughed at that. He liked that. And then I mentioned the son issue, and he really had no real response, which just, I certainly wasn't looking for any sympathy, but I remember feeling surprised that it did seem a chance for some kind of human connection, and it didn't seem like he much wanted one. He wanted a more formal and a more compartmentalized relationship with the press corps. And I think Obama and his campaign set up a structure in their dealings with the press where it was impossible to sort of penetrate that veil. And I think it's unfortunate. It's an unfortunate commentary on press candidate relations today. And we'll see what happens going forward, because remember, Barack Obama promised a transparent administration. He promised accessibility and accountability, and now, he, as president-elect, he's going to have to live up to it.
Peter Nicholas of the Los Angeles Times, who's just come off the presidential campaign of now president-elect Barack Obama. Peter, thank you so much.
Happy to be with you.
And you are listening to Here and Now. And let's bring Julian Zelitzer back in. He's professor of history and public affairs at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. He's been kind enough to be with us this whole hour. And Julian, you started to say that, you know, Barack Obama has to get to work. It's the first 100 days in which a president, a new president, can cement his administration. In the view of history, you know, give us a sense of who's done it right, who's done it wrong.
Well, obviously, FDR set the standard, and he did it right. And in part, you know, he just did a lot. There's certain moments in American history where people want their government to do things. And he was known as the great experimenter, and he did everything from protecting bank accounts to regulating Wall Street. And I think that was one example of success.
But you write I was going to say, you're right, Bill Clinton did it well, but who was it? Jimmy Carter didn't.
Jimmy Carter didn't do a very good job. I mean, he made a series of mistakes. One of the first things he does is puts through a bill. He rejects spending for certain districts, congressional districts, pork barrel spending. And he actually targets money going to key Democrats in the Senate and in the House. And they're furious with him. They can't believe this is what he's starting with. And his first 100 days, he doesn't get much done. He angers Congress. And he doesn't do particularly well with the nation. And from there on, it was downhill.
Well, and you know, we have seen in the past few weeks Republicans in Congress balking at the bailout. So there could be some contentious times ahead.
Absolutely. I mean, the one good thing for him from last night is that he didn't just win a narrow election. This was a real rout. The Electoral College is what we look at, and he has a significant number, and he won some southern and western states that traditionally had been Republican, Colorado and Virginia coming to mind. So he has a lot to use, and he also has just an amazing ability to communicate. He's drawing crowds that we haven't seen for presidents, you know, maybe since Reagan and Kennedy. So he has to use all that. But you're right. The challenges are immense for this guy.
That's just thinking of national security, talks with other countries. What do you see potentially happening, or what needs to happen in the first 100 days?
Well, the first thing, I mean, he's a little like Richard Nixon in that he's inheriting this war that's a big problem for him, Iraq. And I think he has to deal with that front and center, what's going to happen in the next 4 years. It's going to be hard for him to refocus on Afghanistan, for example, when we still have our emphasis on Iraq. But he also has to repair relations with other countries. That's goal, you know, number one or two of the new president. He has a lot of high popularity in other parts of the world, and he's going to have to draw on this, and he's going to have to put in State Department someone incredibly effective. That might be his most important pick on foreign policy.
And Julian, with your historical background, we want you to reflect on some of the things that are being written and said about the election. See if any of them rise to you and stick in the way that sometimes words from the past do. Here's a Georgia Congressman John Lewis speaking last night at the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, imagining that Martin Luther King would be pleased with Obama's victory.
He must be looking down from heaven saying, hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah.
Former mayor of New York, Dave Dinkins, said, we're all drinking from the same water fountain now. I mean, are you hearing, words that are rising?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, to hear John Lewis, who risked his life in civil rights activism in the 60s, to invoke the speech by Martin Luther King, I think, is a very poignant statement. And I think he's right. I think if you're a Republican or Democrat, even the president talked about this today, you have to acknowledge the connection between what happened in the 60s culminating with what happened last night.
Ethan Bronner, writing in the New York Times from Gaza, writes, from far away, this is how it looks. There is a country out there where tens of millions of white Christians voting freely select as their leader a black man of modest origin, the son of a Muslim. There is a place on earth, call it America, where such a thing happens. Now, not everyone is happy. We know that. But just in the brief time we have, has an election of a president ever reverberated like this?
Not for a long time. I'm trying to think back quickly. I can't think of a comparable figure. I mean, for conservatives who did feel out in the wilderness, not in the same way African Americans have, Reagan's election was very meaningful. For many younger Americans, Kennedy in 1960 had some of that excitement of a new generation, a new vision. But I think this is going to be, you know, at the very top of the list. Nothing can match an African American president in the United States.
As far as reverberating around the world as well. Julian Zelitzer, right. Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. Julian, as always, we thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And when we come back, Growing Up in Little Rock, in a minute, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back. In his speech last night, Barack Obama talked about his grandmother who passed away this week, saying, "I know she's watching, along with the family members who made me who I am. I miss them tonight and know my debt to them is beyond measure." Well, that reminded us of the conversation we had with D.C. Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton at the bustling Democratic National Convention in Denver this past August. It was the day Barack Obama accepted the party's nomination and also the 45th anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. We asked her who she was thinking of. The names included Fannie Lou Hamer, the poor sharecropper who became an unlikely activist, and, of course, King.
I'll be thinking first and foremost of the people who made it possible. First, Martin Luther King Jr. You know, Martin Luther King was a very young man when this began in his late 20s. So he could easily have lived to see this day if he'd not been assassinated. I think of Coretta, who gave her life to the movement and who died just a few years ago. And I'll think of my own mentor, Fannie Lou Hamer, who died of cancer at least 20 years ago, but died after not only fulfilling her own legacy about racial harmony, but died after seeing her native Sunflower County declare Fannie Lou Hamer Day. These are the people who put her off the plantation. And in the end, she ended up starting a pig farm so that the poor white people and the poor people would have meat, and they loved her for it. So if ever anybody needed to be sitting front and center, those are the three people I would choose.
That's District of Columbia Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton. With us for a few closing thoughts is our colleague, news anchor Dolores Handy, who's been enthralling us with her stories about growing up black in Jim Crow South in Little Rock, Arkansas, in fact, in the late 40s and 50s. And Dolores, I just watched you listen to those words. What were you thinking when you heard about Fannie Lou Hamer?
I was thinking of the time I met Fannie Lou Hamer, this powerful woman and what she'd gone through.
She'd been beaten and arrested and jailed.
And still believed in that piece of paper we call the Constitution and the ability of America to live out the full meaning of the creed, going back to the Declaration of Independence, that working with it we could get there. And that's what she fought for and struggled for. When we listened to that, I also thought of Barack Obama last night, what he did when he had Joe Biden bring his mother to the front, and Obama reached back and brought Michelle Obama's mom to the front. Mm-hmm. And he sort of stepped aside, honoring them, honoring the ancestors, the people who came before, and thinking about him being alone, all those people who were in that place in his life, who laid the foundation in his life, his mom, his grandparents are gone. That was one of probably the most poignant moment for me last night.
Well, I'm wondering, are you thinking of your parents? I mean, you were telling us that they paid a poll tax.
Yep.
They paid. How much did they pay to go vote?
It was $2 to vote. But I do remember my parents having to pay a $2 poll tax to vote. And you had to pay it well in advance of the election. There were people who worked for $3 a day.
Right.
If you make only $3 a day and you have to pay $2 for the right to vote somewhere down the line, it's not something you're going to do. So it was prohibitive. It was a barrier to voting. So I remember my parents doing that. I remember the colored and white drinking fountains, the colored and white restrooms, the colored and white restaurants. And there were some restaurants that served black and white people, but they had to have different facilities. And the quality of those facilities, the cleanliness of those facilities, all those things, big, big issues for me as an African American.
Well, as a child, though, did you notice this side of the restaurant looks worse than that side?
Yes,
you could tell.
There's this famous restaurant. When people hear that I'm from Arkansas and remember those times, they talk about going to this place for barbecue. And I remember picking up our barbecue and this dark sort of dingy, you know, diner type, you know, bar club side where blacks went. And once they desegregated and you saw what the white side looked like, this was a black-owned barbecue place. And it was bright with air conditioning, lights, great furniture and everything. Yeah.
You could tell.
I saw all of that.
Well,
yes.
And also, you were on the front lines of school integration. You came into our offices yesterday saying the phrase 2, 4, 6, 8, we don't want to integrate.
That was a chant I heard for days and days on end. Little Rock Central High School was desegregated while I was a student in Little Rock Public Schools. The black kids who were chosen to desegregate that school lived closer to Central than they did to Horace Mann High School, the black high school. And there were black kids who didn't even go to Central who got harassed by the crowd standing out in front of Central chanting, 2, 4, 6, 8, we don't want to integrate. All of that was a part of a daily life for quite some time.
How'd that feel to you as a kid?
It's painful, but your parents are trying to protect you, but you really don't know
why they hate you.
That was the hardest thing for me to realize. I have to tell you, the first time I had an experience with a white teacher was in college at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. You knew when she was going to call on you because she never looked at you. She looked out the door. And you never actually gave her the correct answer. It got to the point that whenever you gave an answer that she didn't quite agree with, the white kids would decide to say, well, I agree with Miss Handy because they knew she was going to disagree. Oh. And I'm not sure that I could have taken integration at an early age. I'm glad that I was 18 years old and sort of had a good sense of who I was and what I wanted to be in this room.
So even when integration came, it meant you were integrated into a racist society, and that was painful.
But you know it. I mean, you grow up knowing it. And the good thing about where I grew up and when I grew up, whenever you met someone who was mean and nasty, you also had an opportunity to meet someone who was wonderful and great. My mom would send me to run errands for her, and I'd have to be in the store, buy things, and, you know, you'd stand there.
Because
the clerks didn't notice you. They chose not to pay it.
They
would wait on all the white people in the store, but every time, well, not every time, but quite often I would be there, and there would be a white woman would step forward and say, you know, would demand that I get waited on, saying, you should wait on her. She's been waiting here forever. I feel blessed that in the South, you really actually came in contact with each other a lot more than you did in other parts of America. Because I really don't think that America would have come to where it is now if it were not for blacks and whites working together. It's not something we could have done alone. I think Dr. Martin Luther King would have told you that himself.
You also became the first black checkout girl, and it was at another store, and some people wouldn't bring their things to your line.
My first day, an elderly white couple look at me, they look at their groceries, and they walk out. But there was this tall white woman, I never will forget her, in line right behind them. And every time she came to the store, she stood in my line no matter how long it was.
So many stories. After MLK was killed, you were escorted out of work by National Guardsmen with bayonets. You knew the Little Rock Nine, the first kids to integrate an all-white school. You remember when blacks were only allowed in the zoo one day a week, and on that day no whites were allowed. And you remember a Martin Luther King quote. He was talking about cotton workers whose backs were bent from years of picking. What did he say?
The greatness of this time was what it did for the psyche of black people. It allowed them to straighten their backs. He says, a man can't ride your back unless you're bending over. It was empowerment that came with being allowed to vote. And I knew we would come to the day that a black man could be elected president. I knew that. You know, I grew up knowing that. But I never thought it would happen in my lifetime.
That's our colleague, news anchor Dolores Handy. And by the way, today you celebrate tomorrow you go back to holding a president's feet to the fire, because that's your job.
That's my job.